Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the Trump administration's response to the pandemic. We know the outlines of the story. A president who refused to believe the seriousness of the pandemic from his earliest days. A confused response from top officials and a government that seemed wholly unprepared to deal with something as serious as COVID-19. But a new book by a pair of Washington Post reporters goes deeper, giving us an inside look at when and how things went wrong and why science was ignored in favor of political winds. Damian Paletta, economics editor at The Washington Post, is co-author of the new book, Nightmare Scenario, Inside the Trump Administration's Response to the Pandemic That Changed History. I spoke with him Friday morning. Damian, before we get to your book, I want to ask you about the charges brought against the Trump Organization and its CFO, Alan Weisselberg. What do we know so far?
Well, we know that there were a series of very serious charges that New York prosecutors brought against the former president's company and his chief financial officer. And so they've been indicted. Obviously, they're innocent until proven guilty, but it looks like they have quite a lot of evidence. The former president is saying that it's all politically motivated. He doesn't actually seem to be defending the charges as much. It's just saying that this was a witch hunt, kind of like everything else that he went through when he was president. And I think what we're really going to be watching for is to see if the company is convicted and if the CFO is convicted. That could have serious implications for the Trump Organization going forward. It's very difficult for them to obtain new loans, you know, if they've been convicted of some kind of financial crime. And they owe, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in existing loans. So if they're unable to roll over those loans and obtain new credit, then this could be, you know, potentially the beginning of the end for the company. Because if they can't, they're a real estate company, they need access to cash. And so if they've been convicted of a crime or a series of crimes and their chief financial officer is seen as being a criminal, then it just makes it very difficult for them to operate in a normal kind of economic marketplace.
But what could this mean for Donald Trump himself?
That's what we're all wondering. I mean, I think, quite frankly, if the chief financial officer who has been charged, Alan Weisselberg, decides to cooperate with prosecutors, then it's a whole different conversation. You know, he knows everything. He's been by the former president's side for years. He knows about every, you know, financial engineering trick the president might have used. He knows all about the tax statements. So if Weisselberg cooperates with prosecutors, then the president could be under a lot more scrutiny. But if he refuses to, you know, that might be harder for prosecutors to go after Donald Trump. However, you know, Trump Organization is Donald Trump, okay? So if that organization is convicted of a crime or a series of crimes, the president wouldn't necessarily go to prison, but his financial future could really be in doubt because, like I said, it'd be incredibly difficult for him to obtain new loans, to buy new buildings, to even finance the buildings he already has control of, and that he could be forced to, you know, sell off what they have. You know, and it could be kind of the end of the real estate empire as we know it.
Of course, you've said Weisselberg has been with Trump for so many years, probably one of his most loyal, I don't know what to say, whether to call him an employee or not, but he has stood by Trump for all these years. How likely is it that he would turn state's evidence?
I think it's very unlikely. You know, one thing we learned about Donald Trump when he was in the White House is that there is nothing more important to him than loyalty, you know, to a fault, right? I mean, he wanted people loyal to him over the government of the United States, over the people of the United States. So if this is the person who's his closest business associate and has been by his side for years and who Donald Trump helped you know, take care of his apartment and put his kids through college and everything else. I have to think the bond between these two men is incredibly strong and something that maybe some of us couldn't even comprehend because we don't know what the, you know, what they're like. And so I think it's very unusual, it's very difficult to comprehend the idea that they would turn Weisselberg against Trump in this case. Although I guess it depends on what else they have. They might have some really incriminating stuff on him that might send him to prison for the rest of his life. And then he would have to decide, do I want to spend the rest of my life in prison? Is the loyalty to Trump worth that? And that I think we haven't seen yet.
And what do we actually know that Cy Vance may have that could send Weisselberg to prison for the rest of his life?
Well, it seems clear that they have a lot of evidence that Weisselberg did not pay taxes on a lot of gifts that he received from President Trump. Free housing, you know, other kind of financial benefits. And you can't just give people things like that, right? That's income. That's a kind of income. And so the fact that there weren't taxes paid on that, you know, is a problem. Now, we're not talking, you know, tens of millions of dollars in gifts necessarily. So it's hard to imagine that what they've labeled so far, what they've outlined so far, is something that Weisselberg's in his, I think, early to mid-70s. It's hard to imagine that what they've got on him could send him to prison for more than 10 years or even close. But you do get the sense this is just the beginning, and they say there's a lot more work that they're going to do. So I think we're going to kind of wait and see. But they did have enough to bring charges against him and the organization, the Trump organization, and they wouldn't have done that if they didn't think they had a good chance at getting a conviction. So they might have more up their sleeve.
Yeah, that's what I wonder about, because this investigation has been going on for 3+ years, and then to come up with just this
right.
seems a little less than what perhaps we expected.
Absolutely, yes. I think a lot of us saw the charges on Thursday and wondered, wow, is that it? You know, it doesn't seem like a huge financial conspiracy to defraud, you know, the United States. I mean, obviously, this is New York prosecutors, and they're claiming it was a big conspiracy to defraud New York. But, you know, we're not talking hundreds of millions of dollars here. We're talking free apartments and some financial products and designs that, you know, aren't exactly normal. But, you know, I think in the court of law could be possibly enough to confuse the jury or something like that. So if this is the end of the case, then it doesn't seem like it really landed a direct blow to the president. And it might make it easier for him to say, listen, they went after me for years with everything they had, millions of dollars in investigative costs. They kind of signaled that they wanted to get me, and this is all they came up with. And I think a lot of people might be sympathetic to that view.
On the other hand, thinking back through history to some of the worst criminals in the U.S., that's how they got them, on tax fraud. And
Al Capone.
That's what this is all about. Yes, yeah. Al Capone.
Absolutely. I mean, listen, there have been a number of articles, newspaper articles, about Donald Trump's tax arrangements. And not a single one has made it look like everything's on the up and up, okay? I mean, everything we've seen suggests that he does whatever he can within the law and sometimes tiptoeing outside the law to, you know, pay as little in taxes as possible. And so it's not surprising that the first, you know, prosecutor to bring Kate a charge finds, you know, significant tax issues. And, you know, tax fraud is a big deal. You know, you have to pay your taxes. You can't cheat or else who knows what happens. And so that's why I think if this is just the beginning, then they, you know, you've got my interest. Like, they might have quite a case. But if this is all they've got after all they've done, you know, to sort of go after the CFO who's going to be loyal to former President Trump and to kind of nail the company, which is big and complicated and has all these different, you know, arms and tentacles, then it seems like a little bit anticlimactic from what a lot of people were expecting.
All right, let's move on to your book, which also in its own way holds the president to account in this case, over the pandemic. But, you know, I'm curious. You're an economics editor, and obviously this story had major economic implications, but why did you want to investigate this topic?
That's a great question, and I've never been asked that before, actually. So when I was a younger reporter in 2008, I remember coming on and visiting with you and talking about the financial crisis. And at the time, I was at the Wall Street Journal writing about the crisis every day. You know, it was an exhilarating experience. It was a terrifying moment in our country's history. And, you know, I must have written 200 articles that year. And then I saw several books be written about what I had been writing about. And part of me wondered, well, you know, I was kind of ready for the newspaper part of this, but I didn't comprehend what it would take to do a book about it. And so, you know, fast forward 12 years later, and one of my colleagues at the Washington Post, Yasmin Abutaleb, who covers White House health policy, she approached me in April of 2020 and said, you know, I really want to do a book about this, but I only want to do it if I can do it with you, because the health and economic tensions here are really the story. You know, this kind of fight within the White House over what narrative to follow and who to believe. And so part of me felt like, in kind of a cheesy way, like I got a second chance. You know, I missed the first time, I wasn't ready, but now I'm ready. And I kind of know what questions to ask and who to track down and what the bigger picture is. So we launched on this, you know, in May, when we thought things might be wrapping up, right? There was the big surge in March and April. Then the case count started coming down. The stock market started coming up. So, you know, we thought this might be a story about a chaotic 3 months in American history. And sure enough, obviously George Floyd happened, and in Memorial Day 2020, the country started to lose its mind quite a bit. The second wave began in June, when Vice President Pence wrote that op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, "There will be no second wave," and the second wave began. And then I think, you know, Yasmin and I realized, wow, this is like one of the most important things we'll ever cover. And obviously there were crazy events and crazy comments the president said, but we just felt the characters were so compelling. You know, Fauci and Birx and the president and Pence and Mark Meadows and Bob Redfield. And these people are so three-dimensional, and they have such interesting backstories that we really felt like the only way to do it justice was to write about it in a book. Because this year, I think, is one of the most important ones I've ever lived through, you know? And unfortunately, so many people did not make it through. And we kind of owed it to them to explain what happened. And so I think that's what kind of drove us.
Well, congratulations to you and to Yasmin for doing this, because I do believe it's a very important book. And people need to know exactly what happened during this period of time. There were people in government who, from the beginning, understood how serious this problem was. But the initial response was so uncoordinated. How come?
So we were in year four of the Trump presidency, okay? A lot of the people who started with him, Rex Tillerson, General Mattis, the kind of people who had a lot of leadership experience, they were long gone. And so in year four, you had a bunch of kind of third stringers, you know, hangers-on, people who were very deferential to the president because that's what he liked. And so when they were confronted with the crisis, instead of trying to figure out what's the right thing to do for the country to keep people safe, to try to contain the panic, they were kind of worried about what is the president going to think. And so if you remember, January 15th, 2020, President Trump signed a trade agreement with China. And of course, right around that time, there's a virus entering the United States from China. And the president was really reticent to criticize the Chinese because he wanted this trade deal to help him win re-election. And none of his aides wanted to do something that would upset the president in regards to China. Now, there were people like Matt Pottinger, who is the deputy national security advisor, who was warning quite aggressively that this needed to be taken more seriously. Peter Navarro also you know, who was not known for being shy, was in the White House saying this could really get out of control if we don't do more. So there were all these competing voices. This was a novel coronavirus that no one knew anything about, so it was hard. You know, even Fauci was kind of misunderestimating it initially. And so they spent so much time squabbling and trying to figure out what they were doing that by the time they realized how serious it was in late March, it was almost too late.
So what was Trump's reaction to what people were telling him, his own advisors?
Well, the president has a history of being confronted with bad news and then almost willing it away. Okay, so, you know, his bankruptcies, his, you know, marriage situation, his, you know, in two impeachments, he's able to sort of just barrel through, you know, Access Hollywood tape. He can just kind of barrel through, put it aside, and things just sort of go away. And he, that had worked his whole career. And so when he initially was presented with this, when Alex Azar, the health secretary, called President Trump when Trump was in Mar-a-Lago, and I think it was January 18th, and Azar said, listen, this is really serious. We need to like come up with a better plan. The president said, yeah, okay, and hung up. I mean, he just didn't want to hear about it because he thought, I just got through impeachment. I just signed the China deal. There's, you know, I don't want to hear about this strange virus in China. And it wasn't until late February when the stock market started cratering that he kind of woke up. And he thought initially that this was like a messaging problem, that they needed to have a more coordinated message of optimism in order to get everyone to calm down, that it would go away. It was like the flu, he kept saying. And so, you know, he was really trying to focus on public messaging, I think, until mid-March when they shut down the flights to Europe. And that's when he had this kind of sobering realization that this is a huge problem.
What were some of the biggest missed opportunities that could have made a difference in dealing with the virus?
I think the first one is having to do with masks. You know, there was such a debate within the White House in the Situation Room. It lasted for days about masks. And the debate was partly about science, because they didn't know if masks would work to stop a respiratory virus. They weren't sure back then in March whether, you know, the people could get the virus from putting their hand on a shopping cart of someone else who had had the virus. You know, they didn't realize that it was really an airborne transmission. And so they spent all this time arguing about masks. And there was a view among the libertarians in the White House that we can't tell people to do that. They're going to get offended. They have a constitutional right to not do it. And quite frankly, the doctors did a poor job initially of convincing the others in the White House that masks would be effective. Now, they were really worried at the time about people binge buying masks and taking away all the supply from hospitals. So, you know, the doctors were kind of struggling to articulate that in a way that made sense to Americans. You know, you don't need masks, but other people need masks. Well, what does that even mean? So I think there was a real missed opportunity on masks. You know, I look at George Floyd that weekend. Obviously, it was a huge American tragedy, but it was also a moment that a lost opportunity for leaders to bring the country together. Because I think when the protests and the sort of fight fire with fire mentality that the White House had just turned everyone against each other. And no one trusted a word out of the president's mouth, or at least half the country didn't trust a word out of his mouth after that. And the other half of the country thought they had to rally behind him because, you know, these other people were trying to take him down. And so we went into the summer with half the country only believing one set of facts and half the country only believing the other set of facts. And, you know, finally, I think a major missed opportunity was that weekend the president was sick and it was really scary. And, you know, he based on his health conditions and the fact that he could barely breathe, he was at a high risk of not making it.
You know, I was absolutely enthralled with that portion of the book, which the Washington Post excerpted on the front page about how his condition overnight really had doctors scared. And you had people from the White House calling Alex Azar, calling the FDA chair, wanting to have particular drugs for the president, even though they hadn't been fully vetted. were fully approved. Talk about what happened during those 24 hours.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very chilling episode for Yasmin and I to report out because, you know, I think we all saw the president make that walk across the South Lawn to the helicopter. I mean, that was like the moon landing for me. I mean, that was something I'll remember the rest of my life. You know, we didn't know if we would ever see him again. This is someone who was not in good health to begin with, who, you know, wasn't factual about his you know, exercise routine and stuff. So we didn't know what was kind of going on before.
And we didn't know how sick he was.
No, absolutely. And the idea that he was, you know, given oxygen that morning at the White House and then the next day, it pushed Yasmin and I to find out, well, what really happened here? And you remember that his doctor, Sean Conley, came out and gave kind of confusing remarks. Then Mark Meadows. So we found out that the Thursday before he went to the hospital, the White House was calling the FDA, the head of the FDA, Steve Hahn, and saying, we need you to approve this drug, for, you know, compassionate use, but we're not going to say who it's for. And Hahn's like, well, I can ask my people, but, you know, this is very unusual and it's dangerous. This has not been approved for people. And then they're also calling, the White House is also calling Alex Azar saying, we need you to approve this drug. And it became evident later that it was for Hope Hicks, who's very close to President Trump. And the fact that they were doing that, I mean, that's something you do when you're desperate, right? You're kind of like demanding drugs from doctors that have not been approved. That's something you do when you don't have anything, you don't have time to wait. And so that was really chilling to think that it came down to that. It came down to almost a miracle cure to save the life of the President of the United States. I mean, it was so chaotic that they hadn't even briefed Mike Pence's team on a plan to swear him in if the president was incapacitated. I mean, imagine that. Imagine the chaos, the constitutional chaos that would have taken place.
But the fact was he did do the debate with Joe Biden, apparently not feeling at all well, and it showed.
Yes, that's right. I think, yeah. The chain of events was the Saturday before, there was the White House event for Amy Coney Barrett on the South White House lawn. Hundreds of people, almost no one wearing masks, looked like a very dangerous situation. In retrospect, many of those people ended up becoming sick. The next day, Sunday, there was an event at the White House with Gold Star families. And this was inside the White House. And the president even complained to aides after that, wow, you let those people get a little too close to me. You know, he wasn't worried about them getting each other sick. He was worried about them getting him sick. So that's Sunday. Tuesday night in Ohio is the presidential debate. And, you know, I think we all saw with our own eyes, the president's condition over the course of the night rapidly deteriorated. He, you know, was kind of swinging wildly, making all kinds of crazy accusations. Republicans were very uncomfortable with the way he acted. It seemed like he wasn't being himself. You know, it was very kind of unusual. And then that was Tuesday. And then Thursday, he becomes incredibly ill. And that's usually the way the virus works. You know, obviously, it gets in your lungs and then it starts kind of working its way down and infecting. And he is the kind of person that it could move through quickly. Sometimes it might take a week or more. But based on the way that the symptoms were being exhibited, I think it's almost certain that he was quite ill that Tuesday night. And, you know, quite frankly, it's a miracle that he didn't infect Biden, because they were close enough on this stage that it could have been a real horrific scene.
It's also incredible that he was able to walk to that helicopter to be transferred to Walter Reed Hospital.
Yeah, that was incredible. I mean, I watched the video so many times. He took 51 steps from the kind of exit of the White House to the helicopter. And he, you know, he had a mask on, he had a suit on, and it was kind of an impressive feat considering he had had an oxygen mask strapped to his face just hours earlier, you know, and had a doctor waiting on him by his bedside. But he was able to do that. But then, you know, he was put back on oxygen the next morning. That just shows you how dangerous his situation was.
You know, I must say, I feel that his doctor, who made all the statements at Walter Reed Hospital, truly truly misled the American people. Is that because the president ordered him to say what he said, and his allegiance was to the president and not to the American people?
I grew up in a family of doctors, and so I was very puzzled when I saw his statements. And it was clear he wasn't telling the truth. I mean, it was obvious to anybody in the way that he was talking, in the way that he was obscuring information, saying, I don't know if the president had oxygen today. How does he not know if the president had oxygen? It just didn't make any sense. One of the things that Yasmin and I found in the reporting of this book that really jumped out at us was that the CDC director, Bob Redfield, who was very concerned about the president's condition when he was in the hospital, called Sean Conley, the president's physician, when Trump was at Walter Reed. And he said to him, you cannot let this guy out of Walter Reed, okay? He is way too high of risk. And we've seen this before. They get these experimental drugs, they feel better for a day, and then people, you know, backslide and they die. It happens all the time. And Conley told Redfield, you're right, I know, but he's insisting to go back to the White House. And so that just sort of showed that the doctor was kind of working for Trump and doing what Trump wanted. And maybe that's how he felt, what he felt his job responsibility was, just to try to keep the guy as safe as he could. But
were you ever able to talk with him?
No, we tried. We went through the Navy because he's a, you know, he's a naval officer, and they never cooperated.
The fact that Trump recovered as quickly as he did, I gather, is due to the fact that these very special drugs, not available to anyone else in the country, were used on him.
That's right. They were this monoclonal antibody. It really was a miracle drug in his case, and it made him better. And then on top of that, he was given steroids that made him feel like Superman. And that's why he wanted to get out. So he's like, I'm all better, you know? Which obviously he wasn't. He was still transmitting the virus. And so when you asked earlier about missed opportunities, I mean, I think the fact that he came out of the hospital feeling so good made him think that you could whip this thing, you know, like, what's the big deal, people? And he took the mask off and said, don't be afraid, live your life, we can do this. And a lot of people believed that. I mean, it was amazing to see how he recovered so quickly. And so we had, so this is early October, and so we're heading into October with millions of people thinking that the president had this kind of heroic recovery, and the country could have a heroic recovery too. And we all know what happened. I mean, October was the beginning of the third wave, and the third wave was one of the most devastating three-month periods in American history. The virus was just mowing the country down by Thanksgiving. You know, where there were points, I think, where 300,000 people were getting sick a day and 4,000 people were dying a day. I mean, it was just a completely chaotic, terrible moment in our history, and it all really started that weekend in early October.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Damian Paletta.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Damian Paletta, economics editor at The Washington Post. He's co-author of the new book, Nightmare Scenario, Inside the Trump Administration's Response to the Pandemic That Changed History. Now, when did the president begin to, and how did he do it, manipulate the numbers?
Well, yeah, great question. So remember during there was a speech he gave in Tulsa, Oklahoma in June when he was trying to move the whole country beyond the virus. And he said he made some strange remarks about how he had told his aides to stop testing people. Because his theory was when people see how many people are sick, then they get scared. When in reality, we need to know how many people are sick to try to stop the virus. It's not like if you just put the numbers in a drawer, then it never happened. And so Yasmin and I spent a lot of time trying to get to the bottom of that. You know, was he really telling people to stop testing? And I think there was a sentiment in the White House that he wasn't enthusiastic about testing for sure. And that, you know, they really didn't do a good job of getting testing up and off the ground. I mean, I remember we had a COVID scare in my family and the four of us got tested. Two of us got results within 2 days. One got results like 6 days later and one got results 10 days later. I mean, what's even the point? So I think it just took so long for them to get testing sorted out. And that was in part due to a complete lack of leadership by the White House. You know, and then obviously there was the numbers that the CDC was coming out with about the spread. And that was something that the White House was aggressively trying to tamp down. They were not happy with the way the CDC was presenting data in a way that made it look like this was really dangerous and serious and would require more businesses to lock down. And the political interference in that process is something that it could take decades for the CDC to repair.
So how did Mike Pence end up with this whole virus on his shoulders?
We found Mike Pence to be one of the most complicated characters in the book. He's not who people thought he was. The doctors felt for a long period of time like he really was listening to them and that he was tempering some of the president's worst impulses. That, you know, he did help Deborah Birx travel the country and get the message out to states. He did have an open door policy with Fauci and Birx and others to try to listen. Now, there were times that usually he kind of defaulted to the president's wishes and the president's message. But what happened was early in the process, the White House was very uncomfortable with Alex Azar being in charge. And Mick Mulvaney was about to be kind of thrown out the window. And so they needed someone to be the leader of the task force who had a lot of access to governors. And so at the time, Mick Mulvaney approached Mark Short, who was the vice president's chief of staff, and said, okay, we really want the vice president to do this. And Mark Short thought this was going to be, you know, a bad setup for Pence. You know, he's only going to get blamed if things go poorly, and he'll never get any credit if it goes well. So Short tells Mulvaney, you know, please don't do this to him. And Mulvaney says, well, if it's not him, who's it going to be? Like, they really had no one else to do it. So Pence ends up leading it. They bring in Deborah Birx kind of shortly after that. And for a period, the two of them, you know, have a pretty organized task force, but it really didn't last long. And the politics and the science just couldn't go together. And the rest, unfortunately, is history.
I kept wondering why Deborah Birx didn't quit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We felt like Deborah Birx was a completely misunderstood, very private, incredibly complicated person who has faced years of sexism and kind of bullying and had risen to quite an amazing role in the public health before all this. You know, she was an incredible pioneer when it came to trying to stop the spread of AIDS in Africa. She comes from a military background, so she does not break the chain of command. And that was something that President Trump really took advantage of initially. She would not second guess him in public. She would not flinch when he said something ridiculous. And for a period, that ended up working to her advantage because she had a lot of access to the president because he knew that she wouldn't do what Dr. Fauci did, which was rub his temples or, you know, kind of say something immediately contradicting him. So Dr. Birx had an incredible impact initially in helping convince the president to not reopen immediately, that this was serious. And we have some scenes in our book that show some kind of genius three-dimensional chess where she kind of brought him to a scary scene on TV or somewhere else and said, listen, if you don't keep things under control, we're going to have, this virus is going to be all over the country. But there was a point when the president had enough of that. He didn't want to hear it anymore. And his outside advisors, you know, were like, why are you listening to Dr. Birx? She's not one of us. you know, then Fauci continues to kind of stand there and wag his finger at the White House, but Birx is kind of trapped. And her office was in the White House. It was a political appointment, so she could be fired at any moment. She was literally sick to her stomach every day because she knew the White House was a super spreader site because no one wore masks. The opening scene of our book is when Fauci receives an envelope in the mail at his house, and he brings it to the office to open it, and all this white powder explodes all over him. And, you know, there's this moment where he thinks, oh my gosh, if this is ricin, I'm dead. I mean, he was getting a lot of death threats at that point. And so, and people knew, because he had this big security detail following him around, that he was getting death threats. And that almost made him more of kind of a hero to half the country. But what people didn't know is that Birx was getting death threats too, mailed to her house. People were calling her daughters. People were telling her that she should kill herself. And she was so private, she kept all this to herself. And, you know, the final scene of the book, which I found is really chilling, was, you know, she had been completely, her reputation had been completely destroyed. She was replaced by Scott Atlas, you know, in August, and just really humiliated. And so on November 9th, 6 days after the election, when it was clear to almost everyone the president had lost, except for the president, he wouldn't accept the results, there's a final meeting of the task force in the Situation Room. And Birx confronts Pence and says, you know, we're at a tipping point. You have to go tell people to wear masks or there's going to be a lot of death in Indiana, where you're from, and everywhere else. And Pence says, okay, doctor, you know, I'll take that under advisement. And she refuses to take that for an answer. And she says, no, you have to do it. She said, those people only listen to you and the president. And the whole room froze when she said that. Those people. I mean, she was like laying out in stark contrast for him that those people, half the country don't listen to a word I say. And half the country doesn't listen to a word that Dr. Fauci says. They only listen to you and the president. The country had been split in half. And you know what happened? The president didn't say a word about masks. And the virus just continued to terrorize the country. And Birx was right. And, you know, she'll be remembered for some mistakes she made and some moments when she kind of froze up and didn't challenge the president. And, you know, she made mistakes for sure. And those mistakes are in the book. But there were moments that people, I think, haven't heard about where she tried to do something that they didn't expect. And sometimes those actions worked out and sometimes they did not.
So you spoke with her directly?
Well, we don't disclose who we talked to in the book, but I think the way the stories are reconstructed in the book make it kind of clear to readers that we had a lot of information to work with. And we've took this incredibly seriously, given the consequences and the stakes and the death toll. We really wanted this to be accurate and to stand the test of time. And I hope readers will find that we did.
We haven't talked about the role of Jared Kushner. Tell us how he figures in.
So this is really interesting. He's the president's son-in-law, former president's son-in-law. And he has a reputation for kind of putting his fingers in everything. So interestingly, when the virus starts picking up momentum in February, Kushner's staying out of it, right? Because he knows that his reputation is for kind of meddling. And so he's intentionally staying out of it. In fact, on March 11th, when there was this huge fight in the Oval Office about the Europe travel ban, Kushner was at a meeting in the Roosevelt Room with Ivanka Trump about the Trillion Tree Initiative, about planting trees. I mean, what could be less relevant to what the country was? But he was intentionally like not getting involved. So someone comes into that meeting and says, Jared, we need you in the Oval Office. And he goes in there and everyone's like screaming at each other about whether they should ban travel from Europe. So from that point on, Pence approaches Kushner and says, listen, we need your help. This is kind of a mess. So Kushner gets involved. He was really involved initially with, you know, procuring masks. I think he realized how undersupplied the United States was in terms of protective equipment. So he and a couple of others in the White House, including Peter Navarro, started doing everything they can, calling every CEO, every foreign manufacturer to try to get their hands on masks. And people we talked to within the White House, even people who were not friends, did not like him, said that he actually was quite effective because he doesn't, you know, follow the normal bureaucracy. He's like, listen, we need a lot of masks. Like, let's go get them, right? I don't care about filing all this paperwork or this or that. This is a crisis. We got to get the masks. And so they actually had some admiration for his kind of gumption in the way he did it. Now, there were some things that he, for example, there was this huge testing shortage in the United States. No one could get tested. And he tried to do an announcement with the president in the Rose Garden about getting all these tests. And he kind of dramatically overpromised the stuff that they were doing. And he ended up redirecting so many materials that there was a testing, even worse testing shortage when he was done than when he started. And then I think what we found, you know, was that after a period of time, his involvement just sort of disappeared. He was very active in the Operation Warp Speed stuff, which they do deserve credit for, you know, rapidly getting vaccines up and going. Kushner did play a significant role in that. But I would say halfway through the year, he really shifted his focus to Middle East peace talks. And that's when his lack of leadership and his, you know, lack of any role at that point made it just much easier for people to go to war with each other within the West Wing.
You know, I think one of the most horrifying moments was when President Trump, in front of the whole world at a press conference, began talking about the use of bleach as a possible cure. Where did that come from? I know they were talking about bleach to clean off surfaces, right, but surely not to swallow.
You're right. This was one of the most memorable events of last year. And so we spent a lot of time trying to trace how bleach went from a briefing into his, you know, comments. And what happened was there was an official at the Department of Homeland Security, of all places, who had been doing scientific tests to see how long the virus might stay on like a grocery cart handle or a doorknob. The idea was we need to know if we just use like a Lysol wipe or if we should spray disinfectant, if that's sufficient to clean the virus, or if the virus is like incredibly transmissible on surfaces, then we're like have a big problem. So they do a bunch of tests, and they found that, like, for example, if you have a shopping cart and it's in the sunlight for 12 hours versus the shade, the sunlight's more likely to burn it off. And if you use bleach on the handle, it will decontaminate it. It'll, like, wipe the virus away. So they have this briefing. They tell the people, the White House task force, and someone hears, you know, that there's some positive news about COVID, and they said, oh, well, you need to come into the Oval and brief the president. And so this official, you know, was a scientist and was very earnest. He goes in to brief the president, and all the president hears is like bleach. And the president, he stops, he purses his lips, he raises his eyebrows, and then he looks around the room like, aha, we figured it out, bleach. And then he just marches right into the Brady briefing room, and we all saw what happened next. He talks about how there's, you know, these experiments that are being conducted with light, with like intravenous light, which when the guy was talking about the sunshine on the handle of the grocery cart, not intravenous light, and bleach, injecting bleach. I mean, it was the opposite of what the person had said. And, you know, Birx, as we mentioned, she really follows the chain of command. She sat there frozen in her chair when he was saying this. And people blamed her still to this day for not leaping up to the lectern and saying, this is ridiculous. But she stayed frozen in her chair. And then when the briefing was over, and it was one of the most catastrophic briefings, I think, in recent presidential history, Birx was talking to another White House aide just beyond the room and said, I cannot believe that just happened. I mean, she knew how devastating it was to have the president say something that was so unscientific, because it made people think, what are they talking about? Like, what are they telling us to do? Is this all a sham? You know, like, this is serious. And they stopped briefings after that for a short period. I mean, they knew inside the White House, he could not just go out there and freelance anymore. It was really problematic. But that was the origin of the bleach story. That's something that I think he'll be remember for the rest of his life.
Absolutely. You did interview Dr. Fauci, one of my heroes. And what did he offer?
He's incredibly reflective. He has a Jesuit education, as I do. And I feel like that made him think about this a lot in the scope of history. You know, he was very thoughtful. He had lived through the AIDS crisis and, you know, he had been screamed at during that, obviously, quite a bit. And then he has this. So he's used to being criticized and demonized. I think what caught him off guard was the way that people hung on every word out of the president's mouth. There was a point in April when the president started tweeting, liberate Michigan, liberate Virginia, liberate Minnesota, when those people were kind of storming the state capitals, sometimes with weapons, to say, you know, you need to roll back these stay-at-home orders. And Fauci was shocked that people would sort of take all their cues from the president like this, that they weren't interested in listening to the science or the you know, real public health officials. And I think that's when he realized he kind of underestimated the president's influence with his base. I don't think Fauci had ever dealt with a president that had a base like this before. And when Fauci realized that the base wasn't going to kind of listen to the scientists, he realized that the response was going to be so much harder. One of my favorite interviews from the book was with Sean Doolittle, who was a pitcher for the Washington Nationals. And Doolittle was the one who caught Fauci's opening day pitch in July, if you remember, the pitch that went wide left. And it was such a, you know, that was one, I think, one of the most memorable scenes of the year, right? The baseball season's just finally coming back. Maybe life can come back. And Fauci is walking to the mound. And I wanted to hear what it was like from Doolittle's perspective, because all we really saw was, you know, Fauci walking up to the mound. And Doolittle told me that when he went to meet Fauci at home plate right before the pitch, he could see how nervous the guy was in his eyes. And, you know, I think for Yasmin and I, that really reinforced that there was a lot going on with Fauci that the public didn't see. I mean, he had the weight of the world on his shoulders.
He sure did.
Not only with the crazy virus, but with a president who was gunning for him. All his aides were gunning for him. And I think it should, in retrospect, should be no surprise how wild that pitch was. I mean, we just can't comprehend what he was going through as a human being back then.
Did he consider resigning publicly earlier on?
There is a moment in our book where he sits down at the kitchen table with his wife, who is his best friend. And when it became clear that the president wanted nothing to do with him and was just going to mock him and really try to destroy his reputation, he and his wife talked about whether he should resign from the task force, whether he was actually almost aiding and abetting the whole disastrous response by being associated with it. And it was a really tough conversation, you know, for these two to have who have been through so much together. And they ultimately decided that he had to be inside the room. They could not afford to let him leave. He needed to be there kind of chirping and trying to keep them honest and speaking for so many people who wanted to know what was really happening. And, you know, so they made that decision. And I think that was a discussion he'll probably remember the rest of his life. I mean, he came that close to walking away. And then, you know, the president kept threatening to fire him. And he just kind of hung in there. And then obviously when Biden won the election, Biden really entrusted Fauci with helping lead the response and the vaccine distribution. So I think for a lot of people, he is seen as kind of a hero, although I think he's under more threat now than he ever was. I mean, a lot of people blame him for Trump's loss, and they'll never forgive him for that.
And, you know, you're talking about what Trump and his minions said back then, but we're now dealing with the fact that so many people are refusing to get vaccinated. I presume the two things are linked.
Yes. Obviously, the death toll is the worst legacy of the virus.
Of course.
But one of the secondary worst legacies is how this country does not trust scientists anymore. A lot of people don't. And, you know, even if it's 30%, that's millions and millions of people who will trust the word of a political official over the word of a scientist. And, you know, yes, millions and millions of people have been vaccinated, which is amazing, you know, the way that they were able to do this, you know, in every corner of the country. but so many people were not. And we don't know what's going to happen next. The virus is not gone, okay? No. We have finally done a lot to get it under control, but it is not gone. It is ravaging countries, you know, and there's variants and mutations. You know, the Biden administration is really struggling to connect with a lot of people, particularly in the southern United States, who just don't believe what they have to say about the vaccine's effectiveness. And that could be one of the worst legacies of all.
There's a lot that could have been done to prevent this virus from becoming as deadly as it has. Do you feel that way, having done the reporting you have?
I think that this virus was going to be a challenge no matter who was president, you know?
Sure.
And the idea that you have a virus that can spread from people who don't even know they're sick makes it incredibly difficult to stop. But at the same time, that's why we have political leaders, you know, to lead in situations like this, to have tough conversations with the American people. There was a period in late March, in the second 2 weeks of March, when President Trump's approval rating was at its highest ever, because he was doing the daily briefings and he was kind of had this Papa Trump approach where he was leveling with folks about there's going to be tough days ahead, but we'll get through it. I think it's what people wanted to hear. It's what George Bush did after 9/11. You know, the kind of remarks that President Obama often made after a mass shooting or something. People want to hear the truth. They'll give you the benefit of the doubt if you give them the truth. And the way that the truth split off from the messaging from the White House just made it so much worse. And it's clear that the lack of any uniform, you know, message on masks from the White House was devastating to this country because people didn't know who to believe. And the lack of any guidance on what was smart about social distancing and Thanksgiving travel and all that was something, you know, people got together for their last Thanksgiving meal because some of the family members are gone now. And I think there's just so many missed opportunities that we tried to recount in this book that are important for us to remember, because there will be a next time that might be in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, but we should learn from the lessons and not forget.
Damien, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Damien Paletta. He's economics editor at the Washington Post and co-author of the new book titled Nightmare Scenario: Inside the Trump Administration's Response to the Pandemic That Changed History. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody and Rebecca Kaufman. And sadly, today we say goodbye to Becca. She's off to new adventures and new challenges. She's been with me for 9.5 years, and I am so going to miss her. Our engineer is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.